Fink from BlackRock understands that he can make a pile of money here and set up the firm for all kinds of success, and their pile of Bitcoin can continue to grow with their marketing efforts and then benefit from price appreciation because they're taking a percent of assets under custody the whole time. So this is a pile that can grow and, you know, become as large or larger than anything they've ever done before. You know, the incentive is to print, and so the asset that you want to own that's most directly tied to monetary inflation is Bitcoin. I really do think one of the big inflection points, probably the biggest inflection point, will be getting rid of
Bing Bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Corey Clipston of Swan. So Corey, I heard a few, maybe a month ago at this point, you made a prediction of 75K by the end of the year. And I know you don't like short-term price predictions, but we're ramping up now. We're seeing a lot of these green candles here. So are you still feeling confident going into Q4? And we're recording late October here.
It is late in October, which is much preferred over Choptember. And first off, nice to finally meet you, Brandon. Been watching your handle for quite some time, so it's cool to get to spend some time together. Now, I believe I made Michelle McCory badger me like 6 or 7 times before getting any sort of price prediction out of this Mr. HODL don't trade guy that I am. But since it's already out there in the public record, I'll just repeat it. But yeah, she was just trying to see like what round number I thought we would hit sometime between now and the end of the year. And yeah, I do think we'll get through that 74 and change, or 73 and change all-time high, and hit 75 before the end of the year. I don't think that's a wild prediction. So I would bet even money on that for sure. Maybe a little bit better than even money on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot that's happened this year. So, you know, starting off the year with the Bitcoin ETFs, let's dive into that. There's even, you know, a ton of money that was just thrown in within this past week. If I have the numbers correctly, I think it was, you know, 213 billion maybe that was in this, I don't know, 2.1 billion in the past week alone that was dumped into inflows of the ETFs. Now, why do you think that it's so popular to dive into these ETF products? Do you think it was just pent up demand? Do you think it's people who want exposure to Bitcoin? Why the demand of the ETFs opposed to, you know, just a physical asset?
Look, as far as timing, I mean, one thing that a lot of folks maybe aren't talking about is the real tax deadline for most investors with large piles of capital and assets spread across a bunch of different things is usually October 15th. That's kind of when you actually get your returns in if you have K-1s and investments in, you know, startups and private equity funds and all that kind of stuff. And so, like, I never really know how much money I have available for investing until I get my taxes done and see what my guys are going to file before October 15th. I think I've gotten an extension, you know, every year the last 10 or something like that. So that could be a source of some flows. I also just think there's been, you know, kind of signs from a few different places around the world. You've got a lot of evidence of easing in China, and that they may be loosening the purse strings. And then, you know, I think people are, there's probably a little bit of bullishness, you know, I guess around the election. There's just kind of an expectation. It seems a preponderance of people that are into Bitcoin are optimistic about the price if Trump wins, and it kind of looks like there's some momentum there. You know, even if 538 has it at 5248 or something like that, I think Polymarket is probably being followed on a daily basis by more of the Bitcoin trader types. And so maybe they're just kind of getting a little bullish there. You know, I'm always wary of these things because, you know, you can look at the fear and greed indicators, and sentiment looks pretty greedy right now. I spent some time with Joe Vazzani last week, the guy from Lunar Crush that has all the social signals, and he was like, yeah, it's a little frothy out there.
Yeah, definitely seems like that as well, right? I mean, but before we dive into, like, you know, the Trump versus Kamala, kind of the effects on, you know, Bitcoin and maybe even the greater crypto industry, as much as it pains me to say that, let's dive into a little bit more of like the ETFs and kind of how you see traditional finance with your background. You know, are you surprised on the turn that traditional finance has basically taken in this past, what, 8-9 months here, where they've gone from, you know, Bitcoin is the worst thing on planet Earth to now just pouring billions of dollars into it every single week?
Listen, at some point you got to bend the knee. And you know, the queen of dragons, Bitcoin, will make everybody bend the knee eventually. But it's just the profit incentive, right? You know, Larry, the Valley boy, Larry Fink from BlackRock, understands that he can make a pile of money here and set up the firm for all kinds of success, and their pile of Bitcoin can continue to grow with their marketing efforts. And honestly, just telling the truth about Bitcoin as much as they can when they have a paper product, and then benefit from price appreciation because they're taking a percent of assets under custody the whole time. So this is a pile that can grow and, you know, become as large or larger than anything they've ever done before, and a massive part of their business over the next 5 to 10 years. So I think that's where you see them getting involved. And it's the same for all the Wall Street firms. You know, these guys, they want inventory, they want things that people are interested in. They also really need a shiny new story. So being able to talk about a new exciting product like Bitcoin doesn't just help them sell Bitcoin, it helps them sell everything else. Once they have the investor on the phone and maybe they led with some news about Bitcoin and there's always something interesting to talk about, you know, when it comes to Bitcoin, and then that lets them get on the phone and sell all their other inventory as well. So it's a really good kind of wedge product for them with their client base.
Now, is there, I see your point with that, but I almost feel like that would almost be like coming for their job in a sense, right? Because I mean, I don't know, like when I look at financial advisors and people trying to sell products, now it seems like, all right, they'll just sell the S&P 500. They just are basically therapists at this point, just convincing people not to sell when they see the market go down, and then just letting it rake in the returns because everything seems to be going up and crazy. But Bitcoin would be the same thing theoretically, right? So, you know, are they just going to, you know, keep profiting off those returns and just nibbling off the top? Like, or is the incentive essentially going to get so low for them to sell Bitcoin because, you know, people will start to just buy Bitcoin on their own on the side? Or is this just all, you know, just one big mystic theory here?
So look, I started talking a year ago in the lead up to the ETF enthusiasm about what I called the ETF multiplier effect. And this is basically that once the ETFs launched, which they then did a few months later, you'd see more Bitcoin bought through non-ETF channels because of the existence of the ETFs. And this is just because of the legitimacy that's lent to the asset now that you have Uncle Larry and Auntie Abby, all systems go, and all these Wall Street firms pumping marketing dollars about Bitcoin and providing Bitcoin education, et cetera, talking heads every single day on every damn TV network about Bitcoin, or at least the financial networks. So you've seen that. You know, Swan has had a massive boost in revenue this year, grew up like 132% in the first half of the year over year, had a good Q3 as well. So, you know, I think that's not surprising. And I think it'll become laid even more bare over time that the ETFs ended up being a great top of funnel for real Bitcoin. So, and I think that's because people that end up with more Bitcoin in their portfolio are the ones more likely to go down the rabbit hole and end up preferring self-custody. You know, and so we've seen that data point, and I'm sure we're not the only company that sees this, but basically if you just have a little bit of Bitcoin, you may be okay leaving it with a third party custodian, but as soon as it gets a little bit more sizable, you're much more likely to go collaborative custody or go self-custody and figure it out, right? And so I think we've got stats on something like, you know, 50% of Swan clients have taken self-custody historically, but it's 80% of the Bitcoin, which totally makes sense. And so I see that happening with the ETFs too. I think people nibble, they'll get up to like 0.5% of their liquid portfolio, or maybe, you know, 1% or something like that. And anything above that, they're going to take the plunge and actually learn about Bitcoin. And lots of them are going to prefer real self-custody Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I mean, I hear you with that. Now, do you look at the gold ETFs as almost like a comparison to this? Because I think, you know, it's been almost the narrative for a while, especially in the US, that Bitcoin is digital gold. And, you know, we've seen a net outflow of the Bitcoin, or of the gold ETFs, excuse me, for the past 5 years, but we've seen gold price nearly double in the past three. And a big part of that is because, you know, central banks have been buying up gold all across the globe for at an accelerating rate. So I personally think I could see that, you know, with Bitcoin, where, you know, people are starting to buy Bitcoin, then maybe central banks or other people, other countries across the globe are going to start putting Bitcoin on there. But then, you know, they're going to really look for the physical asset. Do you see that as a case, or do you think, you know, the ETFs are going to be here to stay?
So both. I think that you're going to see a lot of people preferring the real thing, and I think that in particular, that's going to be government entities that aren't tied to the Western system. They're not going to sit around holding ETFs that are essentially under the thumb of the U.S. government. They're going to hold the real thing, and it's not that hard to get the real thing, and you know, it's not that hard to set up self-custody, collaborative custody, institutional custody, governmental custody. Like, these are solvable problems. They are the hardest problem in Bitcoin, so it's harder than other aspects of Bitcoin for an owner, but it's not intractable. It's not unsolvable.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's great. So now let's dive into the Trump versus Kamala debate here we got going on, right? We're recording this October 23rd. So it's a little bit before the election. And, you know, it seems like obviously all eyes across the globe are on what is going to happen here soon. So, you know, we've had Trump come to the Bitcoin conference, speak about it, launch some, you know, meme shitcoin here as well, sell some like crypto shoes and everything like that. And then Kamala has kind of, I don't know, run on some policy that, you know, all African-American men will not be hurt by crypto investments. So it seems like they both don't really know what's going on here. But which one do you think is better or worse for the Bitcoin industry? Or do you see it just kind of playing out similarly?
Look, in the long run, it certainly doesn't matter. I think it potentially has some effects on price in the short run. It certainly has some potential implications for regulatory actions for the non-Bitcoin altcoin space. I would think that you would expect active participants in crypto scams like the Trump family to be a little bit more friendly on the regulatory side than Kamala and the Democrats. You've also just got, you know, you're just seeing a lot of seeking of influence on both sides. Or it's a seeking of influence from both sides by the non-Bitcoin crypto industry, which has supplied something like half of the donations for this cycle. That may be thrown off a little bit by Bill Gates' $50 million for Kamala, I think, just came across the wire a couple hours ago. But prior to that, it's, you know, it's, if you're kind of on like Team Ripple and Circle and Coinbase, you're probably throwing down with the Dems a little bit. And if you're kind of like, you know, doing something much more shady that's like way, way beyond the pale of what Gary Gensler would like to see, then you're probably throwing down with the Republicans a little bit more. So it's, you know, it's a game of regulatory capture and survival for that industry, obviously. And we'll see how it goes. I think they're hopeful, obviously, that Trump wins. I also think there's a little bit of common cause with, you know, the Bitcoin moon boys, because it does seem like broadly there'd be a little bit of a bump from at least the first order effect would probably be a little bit of a bump in price and just an expectation that things would be slightly more, people would be slightly more willing to go out on the risk curve if it were a Trump win. But we never know what the second order effects are, you know, of something like that. And so, you know, it's it just depends. I mean, we saw 5 or 6 years of non-Bitcoin crypto siphoning demand from Bitcoin and, you know, telling all kinds of lies and mistruths about Bitcoin. And so if that crew of grifters feels strong again and, you know, has the stones to go and tell a bunch of lies about Bitcoin and siphon off that demand like they did from kind of 2017 to 2022 or so, you know, maybe that second order effect is not good for Bitcoin. So I wouldn't be too certain about your prognostications either way. And I would just try to keep in mind that, you know, neither party is mine, not the jackass nor the elephant, Team Orange.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that. But it seems like, you know, both are going to potentially push for lower interest rates. I mean, Trump has come out and said it, you know, that he's going to get interest rates to near zero. Now, Kamala hasn't really commented on it, but I have a feeling that she would probably want to at least lower interest rates, maybe not to the level that Trump would. But, you know, historically speaking, that, you know, does pretty well for growth assets, and it kind of adds a lot of fluff into the market. Now we saw, you know, obviously FTX, Celsius, all those kind of things pop up in the zero interest rate environment, go from zero to, you know, billion-dollar companies, and then go crashing just as quickly as they went up. Now, is that, you know, something that I guess almost like worries you? Maybe it's an accelerating factor for Bitcoin here, where, you know, we bring down interest rates at a certain point so quickly that, you know, we don't necessarily have inflation under wraps. So from the broader economy, like, how are you looking at that? And I guess almost like bracing for impact at this point. Are you looking for the best way to store your seed phrase? Well, I've got it for you. It's Stampseed. They've got the number one punch place where you can order a full-on package where they've got every single thing. They've got all the letters. You could just get it in there. And they've got this sick, sick hammer, which they've engineered to make it so easy for you to punch in that titanium steel plate and store your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. So go ahead and get your Bitcoin off of these exchanges and use promo code GREENCANDLE for 15% off. They're helping power their show. They've got the Bitcoin logo. You can punch it into your seed phrase as well if you could see it here. They've got a lot of cool stuff. And now I'm helping empower you to get your Bitcoin off an exchange utilizing Stampseed and storing your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. Now get to it. All right, back to the show.
Trying to have a nice, relaxing afternoon conversation with you, Brandon.
I
stole my wife's recipe for like the iced latte over here. Like, I never do these. I'm like an espresso shot guy. I was like, I'm going to sip this. And you're hitting me with like the return of mega inflation. And yeah, man, I don't know. I got to keep my head down, spread Bitcoin truth, spread Bitcoin knowledge, run the company, you know. Yeah, I think a lot of this is just kind of like reading tea leaves. And, you know, I do like to have a mental map of kind of broadly where I think things can go based on like, you know, this path or that path or whatever. But I really try hard not to be, I guess, that specific about saying exactly what it's going to be. I do really agree with you, though, that it seems very clear that either winner would have the strong incentive to cut rates, because they really want to come out of the gate and gain some momentum for their presidency. And a way to do that would just be to see asset prices going up. So I think they'll try to do that, even though it's kind of painting the tape and it doesn't necessarily do anything if you're causing mass inflation as well. And you're also just kind of taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich, the asset holding class, you know. But again, that's, if you're listening to this, you know, be part of that asset holding class. You understand the incentive for the uniparty, both of them. They're just part of the same thing. They just print money and give it to their friends. You know, the incentive of is to print. And so the asset that you want to own that's most directly tied to monetary inflation is Bitcoin.
And yeah, it's the easiest barrier to entry too, right? I mean, you could buy a sats for a dollar, and yep, you can kind of get in that way. So it definitely seems like the way to kind of get started to battle inflation. But I'll go on a little bit of a friendlier topic here. Let's talk about Bitcoin mining, because we've seen the hash rates actually, you know, completely explode. And we've seen some countries get into it. The Kingdom of Bhutan announced that they're having a legit mining operation for, you know, that small of a country. And then, you know, you guys at Swan launched the fastest growing hash rate of, you know, ever in Bitcoin's history. So, you know, how do you see this industry developing? Because, you know, it always seems like there's going to be, you know, the battle for as much hash as possible to try to get some of that precious coin.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And some of the rumors going around there, and, you know, I'm talking to people in countries around the world that have sovereigns ramping up or creating new regulations or specifically targeting Bitcoin mining when they have a set of regulations rolling off, for instance, and a bunch of new rights coming on. Like, they're actively reaching out to the Bitcoin mining industry and trying to bring people in, trying to create partnerships. So yeah, a lot of people have been to visit Bhutan and see what they have going on there. There is mining going on in El Salvador, although on a smaller scale. There are a lot of rumors out there about China nuclear actually mining for the CCP. So that may be one source of some of the missing hash rate when you kind of add up everything that we know. And it's like, well, that doesn't reach 878 exahash, does it? Who are the rest? A lot of conversations about more and more Middle Eastern nations getting into it. Super energy rich, very friendly business climates, super pro Bitcoin. So it's really easy, you know, to cut deals with Saudis and Emiratis over there and get to some real size. And then there's just like a lot of good hydro projects in north of a gigawatt in different places around the world. I wouldn't say a lot, but there's some, and like, that's a lot of hash rate. It's just a lot when you think about it. I mean, it's, you're talking about, you know, another gigawatt coming online from a dam, which is a big dam, but not massive. That's another 50 exahash, you know? So I see this continuing to explode. I think we will see a zettahash next year. So 1,000 exahash seems pretty dang likely in 2025. I mean, shoot, you continue at this rate, you might see it at the end of the year.
Now, do you think that that's going to almost turn into somewhat of like hash wars, where we're going to see, you know, countries just kind of battling it out for hash, trying to get as much power online, you know, as more of these countries start to come online? Obviously, Kingdom of Bhutan is leading the way in that aspect, but they're a very small country, right? I mean, if you could see something from like US, Canada's got a lot of, you know, hydropower, already has a lot of publicly traded companies that have facilities there. So if a bigger nation kind of comes and embraces this, this could be off to the races, it seems.
So this is really interesting. It's a framework I've started to think about a lot of aspects of Bitcoin. It's basically, how are you allowed to get your hands on Bitcoin? So you think of fixed income investors, and they got to buy bonds, right? And so this kind of dovetails with what MicroStrategy and Michael Saylor are doing. You know, one of the key ingredients, maybe the key ingredient to that whole schema, is that these fixed income portfolio managers can buy the MicroStrategy convertible bonds and get access to Bitcoin upside that's non-correlated with the rest of their portfolio. So it's not only likely to perform a lot better, it's also not heavily correlated, and you know, I haven't looked at it, but maybe it's even negatively correlated with a lot of the other stuff in their portfolio. So it's just, that's a huge arbitrage, right? That you're providing something that they can access. Similarly, I think you'll see a lot of fixed income portfolio managers go after, let's call it managed mining, because that's the way I think about it. But it's basically the same way that BlackRock operates in the real estate space, where they deploy a lot of assets, investor capital, into real estate, and they manage that, right? So I think you'll see that be really attractive for fixed income portfolio managers as well. And it's kind of even closer to the metal, right? They're actually investing, and they get a variable coupon. So that makes a ton of sense that there should be a ton of demand for that non-correlated with the Bitcoin upside into a fixed income structure. So then when I think about the governments, and you think, okay, it's probably hard for most of these governments, not all of them, but a lot of them, it's probably hard for them to just buy Bitcoin off the balance sheet. But because their relationships often with the national energy industry players, you know, in their jurisdiction, can be pretty chummy and can have a lot more leeway and doesn't need votes and doesn't need a lot of sign off from very many people. In many cases, it's just further out on the, hey, we can just control this and do things unilaterally. And so, you know, I could certainly see there being quite a few countries where it's a lot easier for them to get Bitcoin by mining it than it is by buying it with tax receipts or through inflationary money printing.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, because I think we saw, maybe it was like the city of Fort Worth or something like that, was mining in their, you know, city hall like a couple years ago. And then obviously, El Salvador has announced the volcano mining project, and then Bhutan. So I think that it's going to be a growing trend, whether it's on the city level or, you know, on the global scale. But, you know, I guess, does it surprise you at this point in time that we haven't seen more after we've seen a lot of the successes that El Salvador has had, you know, just through adopting Bitcoin just a few short years ago?
You know, I think just like we haven't seen anyone try to copy what MicroStrategy has done, you know, no one of size has tried to copy that. And you have to be of size to be able to copy that, because you have to have a liquidly traded stock and have access to debt markets like what they've pulled off. Similarly with El Salvador, I think what they have in common is they actually believe, like they both, Bukele and Saylor both deeply understand Bitcoin and are fully on board. And it seems like the kind of thing you just can't fake. I don't think that you can just kind of hang up a shingle and say, hey, we're into Bitcoin. That was kind of like, I think it was Central, I don't know, it was one of the Congo republics or something. And, you know, they basically said the same thing as El Salvador, but 3 seconds later, all the crypto people were there doing blockchain things. And it's like, well, that's not going to work. That's just letting grifters into your midst, and it's not going to happen. So I think you have to actually understand it deeply and can't just do it as kind of a marketing play. So I think that's why you haven't seen other countries get on board to the degree that El Salvador did. Because again, the benefits so far aren't from just buying and holding massive amounts of Bitcoin. El Salvador doesn't hold that much Bitcoin. It's kind of tiny compared to what a MicroStrategy owns, for instance. But I think it just completely changed the perception of the country, and it gave them a way to sort of access the global stage. It made people start coming there. It made people start investing there. And as the individuals came in a flood, and then the small businesses started to come, and then the big businesses started to come as they realized it had become a friendly climate and a friendly environment where they were going to respect the rule of law. And now you have data centers for the big tech companies being built, and you have Google opening an office in San Salvador and all these different things. So I don't think you can fake it, is what I'm saying. I think if you're a country or a company that actually gets it, that's the key. You can't fake your way. Just like if you're investing in Bitcoin and you don't understand it, you're going to have paper hands and you're going to sell when you freak out because you think Sam Bankman-Fried is the CEO of Bitcoin or something, you know? And so education, understanding of Bitcoin is basically what earns you the right to be a hodler and to benefit from the upside over the long haul. And it's the understanding that Bukele and Saylor have that lets their country and their company actually benefit from this thing.
Well, you brought him up already. So let's dive into Michael Saylor and the uniqueness behind MicroStrategy. Now, it seems like he's, you know, I guess playing the game right? Using the traditional financial tools to borrow against his future debt to purchase more and more Bitcoin. So essentially, almost accelerating, you know, the growth of MicroStrategy. Now, as a fellow business owner, how are you looking at this? One, and you know, two, like you said, like, why do you not think that there hasn't been, I guess, another big company diving in? We've seen Michael Dell tweet about it. We've seen T-Mobile potentially start to mine, and some other announcements being made, but nothing like of note that has really occurred. There just been announcements that they're going to look into it.
Yeah, it really is fascinating that there hasn't been, let alone a fast follower, there hasn't even been a slow follower. You know, it's 4 years now that they've been on the plan, and it certainly seems to be working. And I think it's the highest growth stock basically in the top 1,000 or something. It's higher than Nvidia over that time period since adopting the strategy. So definitely seems like there should be a bunch more people following. You know, I think there are unique characteristics of a company that would go into this plan that actually aren't very common. And it's because I think there are three elements that you need to have to kind of get on this train. The first is you need to have cash flow, like quite a bit and steady. You need that to be able to buy the Bitcoin. You also need that to be able to service debt payments. The second is you need to be unloved by the market, and the market needs to be telling you that they don't trust you to reinvest the proceeds in your business. Otherwise, it's probably just too hard to tell the market, hey, I am, as the CEO and the board, we are not capable of investing this cash into our business to make it grow faster. We're going to just throw in the towel and we're just going to do this Bitcoin thing because we are not the management team you are looking for. We are not capable. And that's really hard for someone to come out and say when they're, you know, trying to get compensated. And so then it basically comes down to, you know, who is actually in control. And so you actually need somebody that has a really firm grip on the company. And that was kind of a relatively unique feature of Saylor's relationship to MicroStrategy, is he controlled, you know, essentially almost unilaterally. And then certainly after letting a few people get out with, I think it was a tender offer back in 2020, and kind of said, hey, we're going to do this thing, we'll buy you out, and basically cleaned them up and had just a totally friendly core holder group. And then the board and everybody was all aligned behind the strategy. So that's actually not that common a set of ingredients, as we've seen. And certainly not with the type of, you know, size of company that would be needed to actually copy the strategy. Because this doesn't matter. Like, there's no such thing as a money losing startup going on the Saylor plan. Like, that's not an actual thing. It's bullshit. There's nothing even a small cap stock can do, because their stock is not liquidly traded. So you can't do at the money offerings. You can't take on a bunch of convertible debt. So it's just, you know, it's a joke to claim that you're on kind of the MicroStrategy playbook, unless you're actually, you know, north of a billion, probably north of 1.5, heavily traded, and are popular with debt markets as well. So, you know, those are few and far between, and they're certainly even fewer and further between when you need to have somebody who's a Bitcoin zealot and has near unilateral control over the company. And I think that's why we've seen it being kind of a unique formula that MicroStrategy has.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we've seen like four little guys basically come on, but they've seen their stock prices just absolutely shoot up. Now, I mean, I don't know how big of a stock price incentive it could potentially be, because we've seen 75% of S&P 500 companies beat expectations. We've seen still the S&P 500 kind of, I guess, been carried by like the magical seven, or what, magnificent seven, whatever you want to call them now, of the top stocks. But I mean, MicroStrategy's absolutely crushed it. So I feel like, you know, it's almost a no-brainer for a lot of these companies. But you're right, it is seemingly a unique opportunity that Michael Saylor had. And I think I kind of view it similarly to a lot of these countries where, you know, El Salvador, Bukele had a lot of power in order to kind of, you know, implement that and implement the legal tender change, where a lot of countries have to go through a lot of different checks and balances. Now, do you see those as essentially like kind of, I guess, similar in a sense where, you know, Saylor luckily didn't have too many, you know, obstacles to go through. But, you know, maybe some of these bigger companies like Dell that we mentioned previously, who's tweeted about it, might have so many checks and balances that to get into this Michael Saylor strategy would take him, you know, maybe years to get this through.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I've been, obviously, I'm sure like lots of people, trying to think about here and there, not even something that I would necessarily personally or via Swan want to get involved in, although I've certainly considered it. You know, is there a way to replicate in some way to kind of manufacture some of these same circumstances? And at this point, I think it's far enough off from kind of our roadmap at Swan that I don't mind kind of sharing at least what my thinking was. So this is actually the first time that I'm talking about this publicly, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, the hypothesis would be that you'd have to basically bring money to the table. And so you would basically screen all of the public companies, or the could be public private companies, and look for those with kind of unloved multiples, because, you know, it's like selling auto parts out of Ohio or something. But they, you know, I found a bunch of them, basically. I screened and I found like 167 potential candidates for this. And you've got to bring a bunch of money to the table, because you essentially have to pay off like Saylor did. Like, you kind of have to tender offer and basically say, hey, if you're not down with the strategy, I'll buy you out at a premium. And you do that with all your shareholders, and you basically take control and you say, hey, we, the new outsiders, essentially the activists that are going to come in and turn the company orange, you take over treasury, you take over IR, you take over the board. You got to have, you know, 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 7 or something like that to do it. And, you know, I don't think this is something that you can pull off, you know, bringing like a 300 million pipe to a 1.5 billion company. I think you have to be bringing something like $1 billion, like maybe 40% of the post money something like that. So you bring like $1 billion to a company that has 1.5. And then it's like, where's the capital for that? You know, like who do you raise from? Who's going to give you that $1 billion if you don't already have it? And so it's just kind of, there aren't a lot of people that are thinking like this that have $1 billion laying around, or that it would already be in Bitcoin and they'd just be kind of doing it. So I think it's just kind of this search that a lot of us are kind of always in a little bit, you know, with 2% of our time, just kind of, is there something that you could kind of put together that could kind of do this thing? And, you know, I'd love to see it happen. I think it would be amazing. I think Michael Dell would be a great candidate. There are others out there. We just need a couple of them to get orange pilled. And, you know, it's almost like what you need is a company that's uniquely focused on just this to go and do the roadshow and basically go do the meetings with the 167 companies that I found. Kind of like what Samson and Jan3 is doing with any government at any level of any national government. Basically, like they'll show up, they'll do the meeting, the photo op, sit around the table, listen to their life story about, you know, bureaucratic rising or whatever, and slip some Bitcoin in there. You kind of have to be willing to do that with a bunch of these kind of, you know, companies that have been around for 20, 30, 40 years and have good cash flow and unloved multiples, but you could turn them orange by essentially pumping a bunch of cash into them and taking them over. It's just, that takes a lot of effort. And I think it's not something that you could do, you know, even just with like a division of like a Swan or a NYDIG. I don't think it's doable. I think it has to be the whole company focused on just that and trying to build a little portfolio of, you know, maybe doing one or two a year. And build a little portfolio of MicroStrategy clones. I do think it's doable. I just think it's a lot harder than people realize for all the reasons that we just discussed.
Yeah, and I mean, just doing a little, like one or two a year, it sounds like you need to bring $1 billion or $2 billion to the table for that. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it is a lot of capital to do that. But you know, would you think a big catalyst for this? I mean, it seems like every single cycle, the catalyst is number go up for a lot of the normies. That's what gets the headlines. That's what Fox News, Fox Business, you know, MSNBC, all those places, that they'll start touting all the Bitcoin people around when the price starts to go up. So I guess, do you think that would be a potential driver to bring more of these either companies or maybe even, you know, somebody listening to this here decides to start that up once Bitcoin hits 100K. Do you think that's going to be, a driving factor?
Yeah, I think it would certainly make more people willing hand raisers. You know, it's a catalyst, right? Just like it's so much easier to go and talk to, you know, guys that run multi-billion-dollar RIAs, registered investment advisors. Those meetings were really hard to get a couple of years ago. And now they just kind of walk in the door. And I'm just getting requests. Hey, can you go meet with this guy? He's got 2 billion. Hey, can you take a call with and do a Zoom with this guy and his team? They've got 8 billion. Like that's just kind of normal now. And I think it's because they're getting a lot of inbound noise and a lot of their clients talking about Bitcoin. Maybe they have ETFs on their platform, but they have clients that want to hold real Bitcoin and they're looking for, you know, how do you do that? And yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. Hey, Brandon, I want to go back for a sec to, you said that some of the stocks that adopted Bitcoin saw big bumps from their strategy. And I was just curious, like which would that be? It doesn't seem to be similar. Similar announced May 28th. And I guess they got a bump when they first came out with that. They were like 23. But it's trading at 26 now. So it's not like way up or anything.
Okay. Well, yeah, they did see an initial spike when I was like tracking these stocks when they first announced it. They saw, you know, maybe anywhere from like similar DeFi. They all saw just a big giant, you know, bump from that initially. So I'll have to go back and like double check, but... Are you looking for the easiest way to get your Bitcoin off an exchange? Well, I've got it for you. It's Foundation Devices. They've got the number one hardware wallet in the Passport. They've even got a concierge service that can help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange within 1 hour private onboarding session. And they've got a great app too, which will give you extremely, extremely, extremely private features on that app. So you can use Bitcoin in the most secure way possible. So I've been working hard trying to get sponsors to help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange. And I found it with Foundation. And you can store your seed phrase with a stamp seed punch plate as well. So pair all those together. Use promo code GREENCANDLE at foundation.xyz and you'll get $10 off your entire order. All right, that's enough for me. Back to the show.
You know, I see it. It definitely had a bump at first, but then it ended up trading back below when they made the announcement. So I just don't think it's a... Again, I think it's a nice announcement, and maybe you've got some people now know about your stock that never did before, but just buying Bitcoin on your balance sheet alone, I mean, that's not anything close to what you're seeing with MicroStrategy, because the key ingredient, again, is just this arbitrage of being able to access cheap debt, because you know the fiat system needs to keep interest rates below where they naturally should be, which means that these fixed income portfolio managers can't get the returns that they should, which means that there's just this massive arbitrage if they can get exposure to the upside of Bitcoin price through a debt instrument. That's the key ingredient. Everything else is secondary to the mispricing of interest rates.
Yeah, and I hear you on that. I think you're nailing it there too, where I think, you know, that it's... essentially, like, it's good publicity at a certain point in time, yes. Right? And it's so like DeFi technology.
But you got to have the goods. Like, you can't announce a Bitcoin strategy as El Salvador and then not make it a safe place to travel, right?
It
gets you the attention. Then what do you do with it? So I think with a lot of these companies, it's like, yeah, make the announcement. Now you got eyes on you. Now your business has to actually deliver, unless you can actually set up the the money glitch, essentially the speculative attack on the debt laden fiat system that Sailor has going. So, you know, I would be looking to see, can you load up this company with convertible debt? That's probably the key.
Yeah. And I think that there's steps to it, right? I think the initial step would be like, all right, we're going to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet and then it's the convertible debt, but you need to have good cash flow to do that. So I think, you know, you spoke about it earlier. That was the unique situation that, you know, MicroStrategy had, is their software company, very sticky. They had continuous cash flow coming in. It's just, it was kind of going sideways. And instead of Sailor riding off into the wind, he implemented this this Bitcoin strategy to have it on the balance sheet, which I think, was very unique. And so I think
market cap and liquidity, you can't be a small cap and pull this off.
Oh yeah. I mean, of course. Yeah. I mean, Sailor is that, they're like closing in as one of the top, like you said, they were the top returner for the S&P 500 from year to date. Since they've been, implementing this, they've been beating companies like Nvidia. I mean, they're, the darling of the S&P 500, if you're just willing to buy into that, it's almost as good as seemingly like a levered play on Bitcoin almost as well too. So it's kind of interesting the way that this has all, played out, but we've only seen like I said, four small guys get into it, but you see that initial bump and I haven't quite followed it too much closely afterwards, but it seems like they're coming back to earth. But it makes sense, right? Because of the uniqueness of MicroStrategy and what is going on there. But, Sailor did make a comment here recently about, looking at self-custody versus, just holding it on the ETFs or potentially holding it through, some of these other partners. Now, you at Swan, you guys are big proponents of self-custody. Now, with the way that these businesses would have to hold, do you ever see that as being a world where, maybe a publicly traded business could hold their own keys and everything like that? Or do you always think that there's going to be some sort of room for, an ETF or maybe a Fidelity or, a Swan Private kind of holding it for companies to, expand that and kind of putting, the liability on another party opposed to, a company holding their own private keys?
I think it'll certainly be doable from a regulatory standpoint. It's probably a little bit fuzzy and a little bit gray and hard to work through today, which is why you don't see any companies above kind of small and medium sized business, mostly you know, pretty closely controlled, kind of founder controlled or sort of owner controlled businesses that that will self custody for an entity. So I understand why they're not fighting that fight. He's also got, you know, look, we don't know from the outside what kind of game is being played and exactly why he says what he says when he says it, because, you know, I think he knows probably why he does it. And also he's not infallible. And I think he'd like to restate things sometimes that may come out the wrong way. You know, as good a salesman and speaker as he is, we all make mistakes. And I think that he would probably turn the clock back and say a few things that he said on a podcast last week with different wording. And I think you've seen that kind of restatement this morning on X. He kind of restated what he really meant. And it was basically, look, I think it boiled down to, you know, his view is that more people, entities, governments buying more Bitcoin is good for everybody. And if you are willing and able to hold Bitcoin in self-custody, you should. If it is exceptionally difficult or illegal to self-custody Bitcoin, depending on your jurisdiction and the type of entity that you are hodling for, then you're going to have to look at something like qualified custodian. And, you know, that's kind of always been the case, you know, and, you know, for the same reason, like I'm not going to lambast, you know, someone from my parents' generation for not being ready on day one for full self-custody, but I will try to build a collaborative custody product that they can understand and that they can use and that they can feel secure with and explain it really, really clearly. And, you know, that's what we did with Swan Vault. I just think it's the simplest, you know, most boomer proof. And for most people, that's really the bar for most people too. You know, so you make something boomer proof, it also means you basically get Gen Pop as well. That's pretty much everybody. So I think that kind of is the key to this, is just making it easier and easier. I think you're also seeing, you know, multi-jurisdictional, multi-institutional collaborative custody spring up, which is also very cool. I think historically most enterprises have gone for something along the lines of like, you know, multi-party compute with keys spread across iPhones and signing devices and things like that. You need a quorum of like 6 out of 9 or 5 out of 7 or something like that when you have actual larger holders of Bitcoin. So yeah, I just see kind of it will develop over time. It's frustrating when we want to promote self-custody and you run up against some of these entities, but you know, you've got to create the products and make it easy enough for them to understand it. And you also have to push the envelope on either the interpretation of regulations to help them have, you know, formal legal opinions from top 50 law firms saying that it's okay to do a certain way, or really go to bat in DC over time and actually change regulations. You know, I think of cap gains tax, and you look at all the backsliding that's happening in some other jurisdictions outside the US right now with cap gains. You know, Italy just coming up with a very capricious 42% tax on Bitcoin while other assets are taxed at 26%. It's like, what are you doing? Like, is this heroin? No, it's not. It's better money. You know, so I think the next huge unlock, when we look back 100, 200 years from now, I don't know if we'll be alive or not. See what AI has to say about biotech in the next few decades. But as humanity looks back at this first century of Bitcoin that started in 2008 with the publication of the white paper, I really do think one of the big inflection points, probably the biggest inflection point, will be getting rid of cap gains tax on Bitcoin in the United States. And I think it's not something that's going to happen this decade, but I think we should be building up toward it, and we should be educating people about why that is just, and, you know, why Bitcoin is money and why it's good for America that we have a neutral money alongside the dollar or whatever is still around, you know. But I do think it's something that we can get done in the 2030s. And I think, you know, doing a gap analysis and saying like, here's where we are and here's where we need to go, that's the type of thing that I would actually do a lot of long-term planning for. And it's kind of something I do a lot of thinking and talking about privately. And I think, you know, we'll get more vocal about it and try to actually affect things, you know, in kind of like a decade time scale, and try to get, you know, cap gains tax for Bitcoin removed hopefully in the 2030s. And I think that will be the big unlock for Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, because then you're not selling when you spend.
Yeah, that is interesting, because we did have RFK Jr. kind of hint at that. Obviously, he's not on the ballot anymore, but you know, he's going to be working with Trump in some capacity. So maybe that's an idea he floats in his ear. I'm not optimistic that it's going to get passed in this next 4 years. But, you know, it definitely is. It's interesting that the conversation is starting now. So I agree with you. I could see that definitely happening in the 2030s. You know, the next whoever the next president is maybe, you know, floating it around after Trump in 2028 as well. So, you know, that is pretty interesting you know, I think it'll just see a snowball effect. Obviously, we see Italy. People are going to go where the incentives lie, especially businesses as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a huge driver. But, you know, obviously you've got Swan and you guys got a lot of great things going there. So do you have anything, any big plans coming up, any big things coming up here in Q4 for Swan here, Corey?
We do. This new product won't launch until probably Q1, but we should have a wait list out in Q4 for this to be announced product. So it's an announcement about an announcement about an announcement. And that's more crypto style, I guess, than Bitcoin style. But yeah, I am excited. We've been working hard on something that I think the market really desires. And I'm looking forward to letting it see the light of day. But yeah, I mean, really, we actually just released to the general public in Q3, the Swan Vault product. So swan.com/vault. It's a 2 out of 3 collaborative custody multi-sig. We send you 2 Blockstream Jades. We built it in partnership with Blockstream. It really is elegant. We support it incredibly well because you've got a huge team of people that know that device inside and out and support basically just that device for this product. You know, so I think that's been exciting to watch that grow, and it's kind of hockey sticking right now as people learn that it's out there. And again, it's just it's a great way to be able to take self-custody, but also have a little bit of help and know that you're going to be better set up for inheritance and, you know, not being the single point of failure for your family, things like that. So it's very popular when it comes to those people that kind of think about the next generation. But yeah, I mean, just broadly, like, excited to see all of the developments in the space. I love people buying more Bitcoin. Oh, look. We will actually have limit orders here in a couple of months, it looks like. So that'll be exciting. I know a lot of people like to kind of set their out of the money bids and be able to scoop a dip and just kind of have some money sitting there. So I think that'll be exciting. I know a lot of Swan users have wanted that for a long time. So it'll be good to get that out.
There we go. Awesome stuff. Well, Corey, I'm gonna end with some fun questions here. You're a big basketball guy, right? Are you a Lakers fan? First question.
No, I'm a Sonics fan. We haven't lost a game in 16 years.
There we go. So wait, are you a converted Thunder fan or what?
No. Actually, I've recently made my peace with the city of Oklahoma City. I actually hated them for a long time for stealing the team in very shady circumstances orchestrated by a criminal. But true story, Clay Bennett, name that shall live in infamy. You know, I think now that we have a sniff of the Sonics probably coming back, probably alongside Vegas in fall of 26, I can let it go. It's okay. It's okay. I went and visited when I was an advisor to the Riot Platforms board, and I went out there and visited the team and site and everything, and got to see Oklahoma City. And I was like, oh man, y'all are like so nice, and you got this clean downtown. I can't hate you guys. It's okay. You can have it.
All right. Well, yeah. Then who's on the Mount Rushmore of the Supersonics? We did have Kevin Durant. You guys did have Kevin Durant there for like one.
We had his rookie year. Yeah. We had his rookie year.
So does he make it, or do you got what, Gary Payton? You guys had some great teams back then.
Yeah. So look, there was in history, and I think this is a verifiable fact and is not opinion, there was no more exciting brand of basketball ever played than the early 90s Seattle Supersonics with Gary Payton and Sean Kemp. It was just a dunk fest all the time. They had to play their asses off. They're the last NBA team to full court press, you know, for much of the game many times. And this was before they kind of got hold of some shooters. And, you know, it was the Derek McKee Sonics, not the Detlef Schrempf Sonics. And so we basically couldn't hit an outside shot. And so they had to play ferocious defense and they had to dunk on people all the time. So yeah, those were my favorite years. And actually my favorite team, I think the one that was probably the most entertaining, unfortunately, is the one that lost that first round series to the 8 seed Denver Nuggets. If you remember Mutombo, you know, lying on his back with the ball, that was actually the most entertaining Sonics team. And I think the most entertaining basketball team of all time.
All right. Well, then I got to ask then, who's your GOAT? Why is it Michael Jordan? Is it because
it is MJ. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely is Jordan. And yeah, there's no comparison. That dude would go for 50 a game in today's NBA easily.
All right. Then, then do you have a NBA finals or NBA championship prediction here that you want to make so we can revisit this in 9 months, down the road?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, who gets there? Look, I'll just tell you, I actually just watch it for fun at this point until the Sonics come back. And so I'm really excited to see year two of Wimby. Also my wife and I bought a chunk of his sports drink company. So he needs to go to the moon. let's go barcode. Let's go Wimby. Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously just super excited to see the continued development of Anthony Edwards. I mean, he's 23 this year and just unbelievably magnetic. Love watching that guy. And then just all the old heads, you know, just getting to go to a Clippers game and a Lakers game every now and again and seeing these guys still around. I mean, it is pretty special to catch LeBron on a night when his body feels good and he just kind of looks like the LeBron of old. Or just every once in a while, you know, he takes like 3 quarters off, but then in the fourth quarter, he, you know, gets 3 layups and 2 threes in a fourth quarter and they somehow win. And it's like, it's just kind of nice. I've not been the biggest LeBron fan over the last 20 years, but as he's getting older, it's easier to be more sympathetic and just kind of appreciate him for who he is. Not as good as MJ, but very good.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I'm a Chicago guy too, so MJ is always going to be my GOAT. And, you know, he kept Derrick Rose out of the finals for a few years, so I'm always a little salty towards LeBron. But
we got to talk about Scammy Crippen. What's that guy up to?
Oh, man. I don't know.
Scotty pumping altcoins, man. No good.
Yeah, he had a dream. Satoshi came to Scotty Pippen in his dream, said Bitcoin's going to be some price by some date. You see him tweeting that out. I don't know, man.
I love Scottie Pippen, by the way, and I know this is obviously like he needs money and some marketing team took over his handle, so like it's not a knock on Scottie, whatever. Guy was in my fundraising deck and business plan deck for like 4+ years for Swan, a picture of Michael and Scottie with a Bitcoin logo replacing Michael's head and a Swan logo replacing Scottie's head, like just saying, hey, we're just on the team. I also had kind of an intellectual hero. I really enjoyed all of Taleb's books and been kind of following the guy since about 2001 or 2002 when The New Yorker first wrote about him, like before he put a book out. So, I mean, this goes way, way back. Anyway, a couple of years ago, I sparred with him over Bitcoin and he ended up, you know, retweeting me and calling me a bit idiot or something like that. I was like, okay, that goes on the trophy case. Anyway, so Scotty's marketing team from his handle, pumping their shitcoin, retweeted me with a bunch of hate. I was calling them out for their scam. So I was like, yeah. I don't know, like which one is better, Taleb or Scotty? Like if you get,
I don't know, man. I don't know at this point, because it seems like, I mean, there's been a lot of negative things since Scotty has retired. I mean, his, The Last Dance, I don't know if that really made him look that great. And then, now this on Twitter, he's just pumping all these shit coins. But the last question I got to ask you on all this is like, what do you think of this LeBron Bronny situation we got going on? I think it's cool, but I don't know, man. I almost feel a little bad for Bronny. It seems like he's being touted out there a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sucks for him because there's basically no one he's going to run into that thinks he deserves it, which is terrible. So he's going to have to earn it. You know, the numbers will show whether he belongs in the NBA or not, you know, and it's not impossible. It probably won't happen. You know, he's probably Craig Griffey. Yeah. 90s Mariners reference. There was a moment there where they traded for Ken Griffey Sr. so he could play with his son Ken Griffey Jr. And then they were like, you know, fuck it, let's get Craig out here and start an outfield full of Griffeys for a few games. And Craig really wasn't much of a player. So you know, but if he had performed and if he had come out and, you know, gone 5 for 16 in that series, you know, maybe it's a different story. But, you know, we'll see if Bronny gets any playing time and like can do anything. I think it's probably doubtful. And then you'll probably be back to, it was a pretty funny tweet I saw, I think this morning or yesterday. And it was, you know, LeBron talking about how great it is and what a gift from God it is that he gets to, you know, bring his son to work. And it's like, well, why didn't you just put him on the marketing team like everybody else does?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, look at it. I'll take him. I'll take him. We can put him on the Bitcoin marketing department. Bronny, come on over, bro. We can put you right next to Dellavedova as a VP of business development, and you can be on the Bitcoin marketing team.
There we go. And hey, Deli, former teammate of LeBron as well. So, I mean, it'll everything will come full circle then at that point. So
that's right.
All right, Corey, you've been very generous with your time. So I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Why don't you tell the people where they can find out more about you and Swan?
Yeah. So let me see if I can do the handle thing over here. Corey Clipston, all one word on Twitter. We're also swan.com and we're just Swan on Twitter. Hit us up. My DMs are open, so you can ping me with anything. And yeah, appreciate the time. Super fun, Brandon. Congrats on the podcast and keep it up.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the time. And I'll put all that in the show notes. So everybody go check out Swan. Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.